The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, the weeks are counting down to Election Day. Republicans are trying to flip control of both houses of Congress. We'll hear from Ronna McDaniel, chair of the Republican National Committee.
It is really, really radical what they're willing to do to their state.
And Indiana Congressman Jim Banks, chair of the Republican Study Committee.
Republicans have come together finally.
Eric Schmidt, the GOP nominee for the open Senate seat in Missouri, looks at what his opponents are trying to do.
The Democrats are two votes away from fundamentally changing this country forever.
And Governor DeSantis ups the ante on the battle over our nation's borders. We'll take a closer look.
The only thing I hear them getting upset about is you have 50 that end up in Martha's Vineyard. Then they get really upset.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program, please, as well, at Town Hall Review. We will start with the upcoming election. Democrats are getting nervous, more nervous. From the botched and deadly pullout from Afghanistan to the massive governmental spending fueling our decades-high inflation, and the blowback from Biden's college debt giveaway and the 87,000 new IRS employees, Democrats in Congress are fearing accountability. But accountability is coming. Ronna McDaniel is working hard on it. Since 2017, Ronna has been the chair of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. She was a guest on my program. Let's start with the Senate, then move to the House, then move to the governorships. Ronna McDaniel. Republicans have to hold Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and North Carolina. I think Wisconsin, Ohio, and North Carolina are locked up tight. I think PA is 50-50. What's your assessment?
I would agree. I think Ron Johnson's in a tough race in Wisconsin. They're going to spend a lot of money there, too, but the polling has been showing him ahead. JD's been very strong in Ohio, North Carolina. Ted Budd's been doing well, and that's a state where we've had big voter registration gains, and we did very well in 2020 across the board. So I agree. I think Pennsylvania is 50-50. Oz is closing, though, and it's peaking at the right time in some of these states, and I think he's doing the right thing, hitting Fetterman on crime, and that is really the issue that's moving the needle in Pennsylvania right now.
Okay, tough question that people have split on. Who is more radical, Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin or John Fetterman in Pennsylvania?
Oh, I think it's a tie. A tie for radical, pro-criminal, crazy socialist policies. I mean, they've been terrible. Yeah. But it's frightening when you look at the type of prisoners that they have been part of releasing or called for being released. It is really, really radical what they're willing to do to their states. And I think as the voters get a look at them and what their policies are and their records, it's waking them up and bringing them to the Republicans.
Now, voting begins in Minnesota. What do we do in a place like Minnesota when early voting starts? It's going to be September 23rd tomorrow. What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, we have an election integrity person on the or a data person on the ground in Minnesota. We have some staff. We're more congressionally focused in Minnesota. We also have to keep the Hagedorn seat, which unfortunately he passed away earlier this year. So we just get our poll watchers, which we've been training, and make sure that we have a good operation to watch not just Election Day, but also the counting before Election Day in a lot of these absentee ballot voting areas.
All right, let's go back to the Senate. There are three that I count as likeliest pickups. I think Herschel's going to win in Georgia. I feel so confident about that because he's the nicest guy in Georgia. I think Adam Laxalt's going to win in Nevada. They've had it with the invisible senator. But I also think in the top three is a surprise. Joe O'Day is going to win in Colorado. Those are my top three pickups. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. I like them all three. I still put Blake Masters in there. I think Blake is doing a good job in surging and really hitting the issues hard. And the more he exposes Mark Kelly as being the one vote that could have stopped the Biden administration, knowing what's happening in Arizona on the border and his refusal to do that, I think it really hits home. And then I still have hope for Don Bolduc in New Hampshire. So I'm with you. And Tiffany Smiley, I was on a plane with her yesterday in Washington. She's just amazing.
That's my second tier. And I actually have three tiers because I put Blake Masters. My most confidence are in Georgia, Nevada, and Colorado. Then I have Blake. Then I have Washington and New Hampshire. So let's talk about Arizona. Do you remember, Ronna, you weren't the chairwoman yet. It might have been during the benighted reign of Michael Steele. But Ed Gillespie almost beat Mark Warner, and the polls said he was 9 points down in 2014. That's what I tell everyone. You just can't believe these polls. They're always wrong.
You can't. And we actually showed this a couple weeks ago, Hugh, to a lot of our investors, which is there's a pattern. It goes all the way to 2014, like you said. But even in 2020, there was not a single poll that had Susan Collins winning. Tom Tillis was behind in North Carolina. And part of this is to suppress support for Republican candidates, I think from the big donors, actually, and then to ramp up support for Democrats. And it has been wrong. If the media, the legacy media was correct, then we would have lost 15 House seats in 2020 instead of picking up 15 House seats. They're just wrong. So I think everybody needs to get out, work as hard for these candidates. Momentum's on our side. And I think if you look at the polls, they always underrepresent Republican voters. That's what I think is consistent.
Now, I work for The Washington Post, so I hate to say this, but I always bring it up. ABC News, Washington Post poll of Wisconsin the week before the 2020 presidential election said Joe Biden had a 17-point lead. Joe Biden won by 0.6% in Wisconsin. I go back to the Mark Warner, Ed Gillespie. I can go back to the Matt Bevin. There are incredible misses. And I think if there's one place they're going to miss, it's Arizona. And I think they could miss big in Arizona, Ronna.
I do, too. Listen, Carrie Lake is running a strong lake at a strong race at the top of the ticket for governor. I think she's going to win. I think Blake, I spent a lot of time with Blake on my podcast, and I love him. I think he's a great candidate. He will be a value add in the Senate with his tech experience and understanding what Google and Facebook and others are doing. But we also have a lot of competitive House races in Arizona.
Yes.
And that gets overlooked. You know, look at Juan Siscomani. He's going to win that seat. We're going
to flip
some House seats, which is
Tucson.
Going to drive turnout for the top of the ticket, too.
Juan Siscomani is a superstar in Tucson, and he's been on a couple of times. Let me go then to the House. So we got the Senate laid out. I'm feeling very good about Leader McConnell returning as Leader McConnell. I think the over-under for the House is 25. That is where, if I was Las Vegas and setting the odds, I think the GOP may pick up more than 25. They might not pick up as many 25. Are you an over and the under on that, Ronna McDaniel?
I never like setting a number in the sand, but I think that's a good number. I think that's a fair number. Listen, when people were saying 50, 60, I thought it was outrageous because we're already starting at 214. We need five to take back the House, right? So you look at the Obama, when we won 63, we were starting at 178. Comparing those two is just not fair when we picked up 15 last cycle. The red wave started then when we picked up 15 in 2020. So I think 20 to 25 is a really good night. For me, winning back the House, 5 is a great night retiring Nancy Pelosi. We just have to make sure we fight the Democrats everywhere. They want to hold on to power. They will do anything to keep it. And we want to make this election about helping the American people. This is an American people first election for the Republican Party.
Is education the Republicans' secret weapon in this election?
Totally. The amount of people running for school board for the first time, the moms that have been so enraged by what happened to their kids and dads, too, that are getting out there, just like we saw in Virginia. There's an undercurrent of that across the country. I run into it everywhere I go. I know I'm not voting for a single incumbent school board member. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're one of them's my next door neighbor. I won't vote for them because what they did to my kids. And no more lockdowns, no more mandates.
Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress have done well in giving Republicans plenty to run against. Inflation, strong fuel prices, a weakened America on the world stage, and I could go on. Kevin McCarthy in the House of Representatives is working on giving them something to run for as well. He calls it a commitment to America.
It's going to be a commitment to America. We're going to hold this administration accountable. This is an American commitment, and it's about American policy and American first.
I turn to Indiana Congressman Jim Banks. chair of the Republican Study Committee and a leader to watch if the GOP takes the majority in November.
But I'd really like to have a select committee on the last 60 days of Afghanistan.
Yeah, understood. I completely agree. I mean, the Armed Services Committee will do our part, and we will launch into investigations. But a select committee on what happened in Afghanistan, I'm for it, Hugh. And the reason I'm for it is earlier this year, I went to the Munich Security Conference to get a go with Lindsey Graham every year. And every room that we were in with leaders from foreign countries, Afghanistan was the black cloud that hung over the room. And it changed the way our allies look at us. It changes the way our adversaries look at us. That was just days before Russia invaded Ukraine. I mean, the outcome of what happened in Afghanistan has blurred our national security lines ever since it happened. And nobody's been held accountable. We have no answers on why the decisions were made to close Bagram. I mean, I served there. It still baffles me that we would close the biggest asset that we have to fly out our equipment, our men and women out of Afghanistan. Why were those foolish decisions made? We still don't have answers to that. If it takes a select committee to do it, I'm all for it.
John Boehner was the last of the Dean Martin Republicans, right? Give me a golf, give me 18 holes of golf, a cigarette and a martini, and I'm happy, and I'll do my business out there, and I'll keep the caucus going. But he always liked to say, and I hate this, we only have one half of one third of the government, Hugh. And I just thought, you know, don't overpromise and underpromise and overdeliver. Do you think the commitment to America recognizes or communicates? We need both the Senate and the House to do anything, and even then, we're going to be at odds because the White House is held by the Democrats. Are we doing our civics 101 in the rollout of the commitment to America?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is really important. I mean, the commitment to America, all of the planks, I mean, from energy independence to the border, even to issues, Hugh, like keeping girls' sports for girls, which is important to me as a girl dad, and issues like that, and all across the board, when you see this unveiled, these are issues where 75% of the American people are with us. So these aren't red or blue issues. These are red, white, and blue issues that are going to bring support from all Americans. And there will be issues that Democrats will have a very difficult time voting against when we put these bills on the floor, because they won't be able to explain it to the American people why they're voting for higher gas prices, or they're voting to allow fentanyl to keep killing off families and communities and the way that it is around the country. So that's what's so, it's not about politics, about doing the right thing and advancing an agenda, but the political part of it is very good for Republicans too. And I think that's why I'm so fully in support of the commitment to America. Look, if it was just me, Jim Banks, one member of Congress writing the commitment to America, it might look a lot different, but this is a consensus document. Republicans have come together finally to draft an agenda that we can all get behind and sell the American people, and an agenda that they can hold us accountable for after we get the majority too. I think that's a big reason why I like what we're doing as well.
Coming up, the battle for the Senate. Eric Schmidt talks about his contest in Missouri.
The Democrats are two votes away from fundamentally changing this country forever.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Roy Blunt, a Republican, is a current senator from Missouri. He's a terrific senator and has been for, well, three terms. He's been a wonderful member of the House as well, and he will be much missed in Washington, D.C. because he decided not to run again this year. Eric Schmidt is the current Attorney General in Missouri, who secured the GOP nomination in August. Schmidt was a guest on my show earlier this week.
It's a real contrast, honestly, in background and in policy. She's a billionaire heiress, and my dad, you know, I grew up in a working class family. My dad worked 7 days a week in the midnight shift. I actually, in college, gave tours and took out the trash at the property that she grew up on. And so,
my God, you get to run against Cruella DeVille? That's terrific.
Well, you know, she's just completely out of touch. And then she's signed on to all of these crazy, you know, progressive policies that the Biden administration and all this reckless spending, you know, the Green New Deal. I mean, all these things that are making it way more expensive. You know, you pump trillions of dollars into the economy. You declare war on American energy. That's how you get inflation. It's not an act of God. It's not like a hurricane. I mean, there's a formula for it, and the Biden administration's done it, and it's really hurting people who can afford it the least. So we're, you know, on the trail talking about the issues that matter to people, and I think Missourians want somebody who's going to go to Washington and fight on their behalf, and that's what this race is all about.
Now, I want to talk about domestic issues, but I have to raise with you the news of the morning. Putin has threatened to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Now, that's not happened in my 66 years because I can't remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. Obviously, you're running for Senate. Obviously, you've got law enforcement, Judiciary Committee background, that kind of stuff. But what's your reaction to a dictator threatening, rattling the nuclear saber in a way at a time when America is especially weak? We've cut defense spending. Biden is infirm. We scampered out of Afghanistan. It's just not a good time for the United States to have to stand up to a nuclear bully.
Yeah, obviously it's very dangerous in a dangerous dictator. No doubt about that. I do think, though, to your point, you know, the world is certainly watching when Biden had the disastrous withdrawal of American forces and billions of dollars worth of equipment lost. I mean, he was just completely incompetent. And we'd be fooling ourselves if people like Putin or, you know, China weren't watching that, looking for weakness. I think also the failure to invest in our military is, you know, a real problem. And you got China now, they're building islands in the South China Sea. You know, their Navy, it's a serious issue. So there's a lot for us to take on. And I think this general weakness and incompetence from the Biden administration, not just on foreign policy, but on domestic policy, makes America weaker. And I think we've just got to make sure we felt, you know, America is meant to be this place, this beacon of hope for the world, for freedom and for liberty, but we've got to have peace through strength.
I want to talk a little bit about the politics in Missouri. Did the Republican Party, after a very contentious primary, has it come around and rallied around?
Yeah, absolutely. No, we, it's interesting. It was a 21-person primary.
Wow.
The most expensive ever, so it was wild. But we ended up winning by 24 points, which was, you know, more votes than the next three folks combined. And so there was a lot of, it was a big win. It was a great night. And, you know, had the support from people moving forward. There's a lot of momentum. And I think people understand there's no path to the majority. You know, there's no path to 51 if we don't win the Show Me State. And
I agree.
We're just going to run. We're going to run really, really hard and make sure we do it. Because I just, Hugh, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, you know, on your show the last time. I mean, the stakes couldn't be any higher. I mean, the Democrats, we're not having traditional political debates about, like, entitlement reform and tax rates. The Democrats are two votes away from, you know, essentially adding states to the union, packing the court, federalizing our elections, open borders and amnesty, you know, fundamentally changing this country forever. They are playing for keeps. And so we've got to win these seats. We've got to take the majority back, bring some sanity back to D.C., control the spending, you know, and basically get back to a secure border, lower taxes, fewer regulations, take on the administrative state. I know it's something you talk about a lot. We just got to have courageous leaders who are willing to do it, and I'm up for the challenge.
The dismal state of our economy and the brutal impact it is having on Americans who can afford it the least remains the top issue as we approach the election. But our porous border is up there as well. Under President Biden, we've had nearly 5 million cross our border illegally. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is not letting the Biden administration get away with the fiction that the border is, quote, secure. Many of you saw Governor DeSantis sent airplanes with 50 migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Now he's not backing down.
When Biden is flying these people all over the fruited plain in the middle of the night, I didn't hear a peep out of those people. They're drowning in the Rio Grande. You had 50 that died in some shed in Texas. I heard no outrage about any of that. I haven't heard outrage about all the fentanyl that's come across the border that's killing Americans in record numbers. The only thing I hear them getting upset about is you have 50 that end up in Martha's Vineyard. Then they get really upset.
George Califf is president of Data Orbital, a data solutions and survey research firm. He joined Seth Leibson on AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix.
Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, Governors DeSantis and Abbott, they did something big this week that I think people are still maybe not fully grasping the import of. As we've talked about before, Governor DeSantis may understand that intersection better than any other elected official in the country. But what he did is he made the media cover something, and he made the Democrats confront something that they denied existed in the first place, and found out, holy cow, Americans actually don't like this illegal immigration stuff when they're informed about it, not even liberals on Martha's Vineyard. Right, George? Am I missing this?
Look, we have talked a number of times together about how important it has been the way that Governor DeSantis has conducted himself, and we can add Governor Abbott into that, particularly what DeSantis has done in Florida. It's amazing what he has done. Oftentimes, when we have a problem, we accept the narrative that the other side is setting, and then we sit on it and we sulk in it. And what DeSantis has done is he has turned it on its head.
Yep.
They gave us a narrative, and he said, you know what? I'm going to up the ante.
Yep.
I'm going to show you that narrative. I'm going to triple down. And he's making them cover it. He's making them feel the ramifications of it. And now the average American is looking at it. We're going to come back to common sense a lot and say, oh, that doesn't really make much sense. Why would they want to not? You know, why don't they care about the border here? But the second it affects them, they do care about it.
Yeah.
He's making the mainstream media cover a narrative they didn't want to cover.
That's right.
And he's done that so often on so many different issues so consistently. Ron DeSantis is the governor of Florida, but he is leading on behalf of a broader movement of people that feel like our voices have been silenced and our voices have not been heard. And he is taking the bigger, whoever it is, the bigger media, the bigger corporations to task on their flat out lies and assertions. And he is forcing them to cover it themselves. It really is masterful, and no wonder he is increasing in prominence in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and on tough issues that a lot of Republicans typically shy away from or shrink from, and it seems to me it's the same kind of thing that made the magic of Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump the magic of Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. They would speak, and people would say, yeah, that's what I think. Yeah, that's what I believe. Yeah, why is no one else talking like that? Right? He's speaking for, you know, Nixon called it the silent majority. I think there was something to that. A silent majority that's silent because it feels it has to be, but a majority that is there so long as the right Republican or conservative can speak to it the right way.
Yeah, and the what was the silent majority under Reagan turned into the silenced majority under Trump and a DeSantis. DeSantis is standing up for those issues and fighting David Goliath-type battles where, to be clear, he is often David and his opponent is often Goliath and then prevailing because he is on the side of truth.
Yeah.
And he continues to do it on a wide array of issues. I can't underscore that enough. It's not just on one or two things he's passionate about.
Right.
It's the broader spectrum of issues.
Coming up.
Now's not time to relax at all, and I'm not going to, because we have to keep this radical leftist out of the United States Senate.
Ron Johnson in his contest in Wisconsin. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment, stay with us.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Ron Johnson was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 2010, defeating the liberal Democratic incumbent, Russ Feingold. Johnson is running again this year, looking for a third term representing Wisconsin. But the sort of liberal he's facing today is altogether on a different level. Mandela Barnes, his Democratic opponent, is a radical.
We have to pledge to continue to push forward on that journey of progress and equity. We have to emphasize the importance of grassroots work in every community, which not only our federal and state representatives, but also our local elected officials. And as we've seen over the last several weeks, our school board members especially. And I didn't even get to the point about critical race theory. Now that's something else, too. You know, it would be foolish to assume that the wealth of America was earned justly.
Senator Johnson was a guest of my colleague, Charlie Kirk.
here. You're running against a very radical candidate who has said some wild stuff. Talk about your race, please.
I'm running against a radical leftist hiding in sheep's clothing, which is what they're all trying to do here. But he's on record saying, as you say, some pretty outlandish things. He thinks the founding of America was awful. He's implied that our national parks are racist. He's the guy that authored the bill in the state assembly, didn't pass, but he supports this, allowing criminals out with no bail. He's part of the Evers-Barnes administration. Their goal was to release 50% of Wisconsin's prisoners. He says that reducing the prison population is sexy. So they haven't quite got to 50. They've gone to 15%, 884 individuals. 44 of those were child rapists. 270 were criminals that either committed, and they mainly committed or attempted murder. You have to also recognize the fact that is the Waukesha Christmas Parade massacre, the perpetrator there was let out on low bail, and he's doubled down on these radical ideas. So he's a dangerous person if you put him in public office in the United States Senate. And so I'm working my tail off. The advantage I have here, Charlie, is all we have to do is tell the truth about him. We obviously are getting no help from the mainstream media, who, just like Joe Biden, they're covering up for him. He's hiding, maybe not in a basement, but he's not answering questions from the media. But I finally got him as an opponent mid-August. So now we are getting the truth out, and I think the change in the polls was pretty remarkable. I'm taking nothing for granted, but I did appreciate the news on Wednesday that the NRSC poll had me 4 points up. The Marquette poll even remarkably had me 1 point up, but it's a dogfight. It's dead even. I will need help and support. Ron Johnson from Senate.com. Now's not the time to relax at all, and I'm not going to, because we have to keep this radical leftist out of the United States Senate.
Senator, can you talk about how your opponent will likely vote to lift the filibuster, will be just another vote for what we have seen of this radical agenda, 87,000 new IRS agents? I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, these candidates, they sometimes disguise their beliefs and all of that. But if elected, he will just be another Schumer puppet for Green New Deal, Electoral College abolition, adding new states. Talk about how critical it is that we hold this Senate race. And he's receiving a lot of outside money, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. They've spent at least $65 million. Jeez. You know, the left hates dark money until they're using it to lie about somebody, to assassinate somebody's character. But no, it's not likely. He will certainly vote to end the filibuster. That's one of his primary campaign planks. That's how radical this guy is. So, no, he will certainly do that. And, of course, he supports all of Biden's disastrous policies. Open borders. He thinks illegal immigrants should get driver's licenses. They should get in-state tuition here in Wisconsin. He likes all the spending that has sparked 40-year high inflation. He supports the Green New Deal. He supports Medicare for all, which, Charlie, you know, that's Medicare for none.
That's right.
It abolishes Medicare. It abolishes, eliminates all private health care, and even doubling your taxes when paid for it. So he supports all these radical ideas. He's, of course, endorsed by AOC and by Bernie Sanders and by Elizabeth Warren, the radical leftist in Washington, D.C. So, again, we know who he is, but the media's not telling us, and he's not telling us either. He's not being honest. He runs these little cutesy ads, makes him look just nice and fuzzy and warm and just moderate. He's no moderate. He's a radical leftist.
Can you talk about this unprecedented expansion of IRS agents, 87,000 new IRS agents?
Well, the good news, if we do gain control over the Senate and the House, I think we can pass a standalone bill to rescind that.
Fabulous.
87,000 IRS agents. And I'd have a hard time thinking Democrats would vote against that. I think they'd realize at that point in time there's a huge political blunder. So that's something we actually can reverse. In terms of comparison, there is no comparison. I don't think he ever had a job in the private sector. Mm-hmm. Might have had a part-time job or so. He's been a political activist ever since he left college. Lied about the fact that he got a diploma. Magically, he ended up getting one. By the way, his degree is in communication, specializing in performance. So he's a performer. He's probably pretty good performer. You know, in politics, I guess you have to sell a lie. He's probably pretty good at that. He is good at that.
Coming up, Albert Mohler addresses the National Conservatism Conference.
Secular space is not empty space. It is space hostile to human dignity. It is space dangerous for human good.
And the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, We've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. What is the future of the conservative movement in our country? That was the subject of the National Conservatism Conference held earlier this month in Miami. The speakers included Governor DeSantis, Senator Rick Scott, Peter Thiel, Senator Marco Rubio. My longtime friend and Salem editorial board colleague, Albert Mueller, had the honor of closing out the conference with a keynote address. For some two decades now, we've served together on Salem's editorial board. Al's also the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. We'll pick up with Mueller looking at the many myths and fallacies surrounding secularization.
Amongst the assumptions of this fairy tale is that the state itself must be secular. No religious authority, no religious privileges, no theological truth, no acknowledgement of religious roots, no comprehensive doctrines, as said John Rawls. Of course, the comprehensive doctrine of secularism, which is no comprehensive doctrines, turns out to be a comprehensive doctrine. So anyway, the secular dream here was supposed to end with a secular state. Everyone's to live happily ever after in a secular state of mind, liberated and free, unrestrained, undivered, unoppressed, uninhibited by even the slightest risk of a theological thought. Now, in one sense, of course, that didn't happen. I mean, the very fact it's a fairy tale is that it didn't happen, and yet you'd have to say it didn't happen except where it did. So, in other words, where this fairy tale worked out pretty much like the tellers of it had predicted was Western Europe, Northern Europe. Amazingly prophetic in terms of how this would play out. The American college and university campus, which is more European than American in many ways. When you think about secularity and the intellectual climate, it didn't happen everywhere, though, in the modern age, especially even in the modern industrialized world. Some of you know the name Peter Berger, the religious sociologist, a brilliant person, and one of the very rare human beings who was still making intellectual contribution in his 10th decade of life. Just think about that. Still writing books in his 10th decade of life. Now, if you do live that long, as an academic, you have to go back and revise your theories because at least some of them have been disproved by time. One of them was the theory of secularization. Peter Berger, the young Peter Berger, held that secularization was the inevitable result of industrialization and mass culture and high technology. It would happen everywhere, inevitably, pretty much on the same timetable, except it didn't happen. Berger came back to revisit his own theory of secularization. And by the way, he did it, first of all, in the pages of First Things. Peter Berger was once asked about the current situation in the United States. And he spoke about a longitudinal study that had been done of relative religiosity. The basic point is they did a study nation by nation as to, without theological claims, just which nations tend to be more religious and which less. And it turned out that, as he said, the most religious nation, just marked by religious fervor, religious holidays, time invested in religion, was India, and the most secular was Sweden. So the most religious, least secular, India, the most secular, least religious, Sweden. And then he was immediately asked by a reporter, well, what about the United States of America? And he famously said, it is a nation of Indians ruled by an elite of Swedes. It's pretty much the way it is. It's a population of Indians, but we have reality, or at least would have reality, defined for us by an elite of Swedes. Now, at least a part of what's going on in this meeting is that the Indians are refusing to go along with the Swedes. And I am proud to be one Indian in this sense, with the many others refusing to go along. We understand that one of the reasons why is because secular space is not empty space. It is space hostile to human dignity. It is space dangerous for human good. It is simply another fairy tale to believe that secular space is space empty of metaphysical and moral claims of ultimacy. It is space hostile to truth and space that celebrates the dissolution of the good, the beautiful, and the true. It is space that eventually will be hostile to human dignity and virtue. Once transcendence is denied, once God is denied, a host of alien doctrines establishes a new religion and a new public orthodoxy. in various forms and places, including recent history, that space has been filled by Marxism, communist ideology, critical theory, post-structuralism, identity politics, and woke activism, all driven by a religious passion and with ideas that invariably take on a religious shape. After the fairy tale, however, I want to offer some corrective history. This is important, too. Because many people who explain the modern age would say that it's inherently secular and that secular means absolutely non-religious. And yet it never was. Witness number one, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It was Rousseau who wrote in his discourses and other early political writings, "I would wish then that in every state there were a moral code or kind of civil profession of faith containing positively the social maxims everyone should be bound to acknowledge, and negatively the fanatical maxims one should be bound to reject, not as impious, but as seditious." Rousseau was openly calling for an explicit civil religion, and it would include orthodoxy and heresy, as every religious system inevitably does. It would be a civil religion imbued with theological authority that eventually took the shape of what Rousseau called the catechism of the citizen. Emilio Gentile referred to this process as sacralization in the modern world. This sacralization means that the state eventually takes on the role of the sacred. And the point is, as Rousseau understood, something's going to take on the role of the sacred. And if you deny God, then the state is the most likely suspect to show up and make the demand of ultimacy. It's not only Gentile, it's also Eric Vogel and Raymond Aron. Aron referred to secular religion as the doctrines that promise salvation in this life. With some corrective history, think about the French Revolution. People say, well, it was absolutely irreligious. No, it was anti-Christian. It was not hardly irreligious. Remember that as a part of the early period of the Revolution, they stormed into Notre Dame Cathedral and removed the Madonna and Child and replaced it with Goddess Reason and actually put in place the cult of the goddess and the cult of reason. It was a state-sponsored religious cult. It was atheistic. Make no mistake, it was explicitly religious, and in a cathedral, no less, not by accident. Eventually, in the revolutionary history and in its sad, tragic unfolding, there would be the release of the cult of the supreme being under Robespierre. Again, a cult of a supreme being. It takes on not only ideological shape, but explicitly religious shape. I mentioned Emilio Gentile. In describing what he calls the political religions, he says this: "The Enlightenment made an important contribution to the sacralization of civil society and of the nation by elevating them to the status of supreme bodies and values for the modern citizen." He continued, "The Enlightenment was convinced that a well-ordered society could not do without some form of collective religion, but educated the individual to place the public good above the personal interest."
Coming up,
the new woke religion has its own liturgy. It has its own doctrines. It has its own promise of salvation.
A few more minutes with Dr. Albert Mohler in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. So, what is the future of conservatism in our nation? What will shape it? And what role will people of convictional faith play in it? Catholic, Jews, evangelical Protestants. Let's return for a few more minutes of Albert Mohler addressing the National Conservatism Conference in Miami earlier this month.
I want to suggest that if there is to be a future for conservatism in the United States, it's going to increasingly be a conservatism of strong theological arguments. And even here, you've heard some strong theological arguments. Even now, I'm hoping you hear some strong theological arguments, and you should get accustomed to hearing strong theological arguments. That does not mean that conservatives are limited to those who make strong theological arguments, but I will say to other conservatives, you're kind of riding on the wake of strong theological arguments. You are living off the capital of the Old and the New Testament of Israel in the Christian church and that witness. We see the great alternative before us. The post-Christian religion of the woke, demonstrating again the Imago Dei, demonstrating the fact we will worship something. We will be religious. That religion is going to work its way out. And by the way, predictably, as others have noted throughout time, in very religious form. The new woke religion has its own liturgy. It has its own doctrines. It has its own catechesis. It has its own cathedrals. It has its own doctrine of sin, its own promise of salvation. It has its own notion of sanctification. It has its own written canon of scriptures and slogans. It has its own crusading flags and choirs. It has its own inquisition and holy office. It has its cherished dogma, and it enjoys the right of excommunication, known more popularly as cancel culture. Well, I want to thank you for having Christians as a part of this conversation and Jewish friends as a part of this conversation, having Protestants as a part of this conversation and Catholics as a part of this conversation. And I just have to say, as the closing speaker and as a Baptist, when you get us, you get all of us. I don't just mean every one of us. I mean all that we are, individual as believers. I've got to show up in full Baptist battle dress wherever I go. I show up with a full weight of Baptist conviction, which means, yes, I'm ready to argue with a Methodist, not to mention, you know, Roman Catholic or anyone else in the room. I mean, what fun is there in life if you cannot enjoy a good argument over what matters? We may be the only people on the planet who know we show the greatest respect to one another when we honestly disagree with one another and respectfully, honoring God and the truth, seek rightly to come to an understanding not only of one another, but of the one true and living God. So, what do we do now? Well, I want to argue that a part of what it means to be conservative is to be committed to the pre-political. If you don't believe that there is an institution before the state, then honestly, you idolize the state.
Thank you for joining us today. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. If you haven't signed up for our podcast yet, why not take a minute to do so? Go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.